Ted Nugent gets himself into so many political arguments these days that people might tend to forget he's a heck of a guitar player. That Stranglehold from 1975, it has kind of a dark and ominous vibe that I thought might fit with our program tonight. The transition from Bill Grabowski to Nick Redfern, I think, is a seamless one. A few people in the world have been down more dark passages and paths, chasing monsters, UFOs, aliens, conspiracies, than Nick Redfern. He's been my guest on this program several times. He's written extensively about all of the topics we love to talk about on this program. His new book, Secret History, is a massive piece of work that looks at the big picture, conspiracies, aliens, New World Order, you name it, it's in there. And when we come back, we're going to jump right into the thick of things with Nick Redfern. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to the program. British ufologist and cryptozoologist Nick Redfern is the author of many books on UFOs, cryptozoology, the paranormal, and conspiracy theories. If you've ever heard any of our interviews with him, you know he is well-versed in all these topics, and his new book, Secret History, Conspiracies from Ancient Aliens to the New World Order, is kind of a masterwork, a compendium of all the stuff that Nick has been chasing after for so many years. Nick, it's great to have you back on the show.
Hey, George. Thanks for having me on again.
I'm not sure if you were able to hear any of the first half of the program with Bill Grabowski, but he was talking about his investigations of the Point Pleasant, Mothman, the legacy of John Keel, stuff that you've written about many times yourself. I thought maybe we would start sort of there. Bill had expressed the opinion that a lot of what we see, the craziness, the wild stories, is probably disinformation, it's mind games, it's extensions of things like MK Ultra. Not to dismiss everything as being the result of that kind of stuff, because he does believe there's some paranormal and weirdness out there that's not so easy to explain, but that's sort of consistent with some of the material in your new book, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, mind control has sort of a long and dark history. Certainly going back to the end of the Second World War and the early years of the Cold War. And MKUltra was essentially like an umbrella program created by the CIA to oversee numerous different kinds of mind manipulation and mind control programs. Everything from hypnosis to truth drugs to even using psychedelics and to try and determine how the human mind could be used. And there's no doubt that if you look at the UFO subjects, we do find a few cases here and there that you have to wonder, you know, were they actually some sort of staged events, testing out new and bizarre fringe technologies to alter the mind? And, you know, the idea that this could have been done in relation to Point Pleasant is an interesting one. I mean, I've been to Point Pleasant and sort of checked out the old areas where the sightings occurred, and it's a fascinating case. I've written quite extensively on it. I mean, I think what makes the whole Point Pleasant thing so intriguing is that there were so many different things going on. You had Mothman, you had UFO sightings, the men in black were roaming around town, and of course all this, you know, outlined and detailed in John Keel's The Mothman Prophecies. And I'm sort of more inclined to think that, although I think the you know, the mind control research obviously is valid because we know it existed, I'm inclined to think that something very strange and paranormal-based did happen at Point Pleasant. I think, you know, there's enough evidence, from my perspective at least, to suggest that, you know, that it was some sort of supernatural, paranormal event, a series of events that culminated in the collapse of the Silver Bridge. And we're almost coming up to the 50th anniversary in 2017, so I'm sure over the next, leading up to the next 2 years, we're going to get to see a lot more information coming out on that case.
Bill, one of his premises is that, you know, that there really was some paranormal stuff going on there, some really weird events that started to get some attention from press and the public, and that he theorizes maybe someone, intel agency, some three-letter agency, decided that sounds like a good place to test out whatever technology or new techniques we might have to take advantage of a situation.
Yeah, I mean, that actually does make sense because, you know, if you want to if you want to try out new sophisticated technologies, well, insert them in an already existing environment, because that way the new technology being tested actually gets hidden by the bigger issue of what's going on in the first place. And I mean, that does make a great deal of sense. It's sort of like with the entire UFO subject. I mean, if you look at, for example, alien abductions, there's, to me at least, there's clearly a genuine alien abduction phenomenon. But I think there are a number of cases which kind of smack of somebody inserting themselves into the mystery and then using that as a cover for, again, testing sort of mind manipulation technologies. And that may come into play with the so-called MILABS, military abduction type scenarios, where we hear about abductees being questioned and grilled by military personnel. I sometimes wonder if it's a combination of genuine abduction experiences with something unknown, and then the deployment, if you like, of similar technologies to manipulate the mind in a similar fashion, really just to see how well the technology works. You know, how closely can they mimic something like an alien abduction? If the answer is extremely well, then that shows the technology actually does work. So.
I'm going to come back to the idea of military conspiracies because you've got some great stuff in this book about it. And but as a slight diversion for a moment, I always enjoy having you as a guest because there is healthy skepticism. You do separate wheat from chaff, but you have an open mind about all these kind of topics. I wondered in writing this book, which is I've described it as sort of a masterwork. It's such a compendium of a lot of the shoe leather that you've burned up over the years. Secret history, I'm talking about. Is there anything that's just too ridiculous? It comes up, and it's just I'm not going to put that in. It would hurt my credibility to even mention it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there are certain issues over
Cases.
these, which I don't mind. You know, if something comes across as sort of crazy and just over the top, you know, I think you can still write about it in a valid fashion, but point out, you know, I was given this totally bizarre story, and I looked into it, and it fell apart and it collapsed. But, you know, you can learn a lesson from that. And writing it up like that, I think, is actually sort of a valid angle to help people, you know, to understand the importance of looking at cases that sometimes are over the top and what you can learn from them, and you know, the ridiculous situation you can find yourself in. I mean, a perfect example, time-wise, in terms of sort of a highly surreal but also controversial issue, is the Roswell slides,
Oh, yeah.
you know, which has sort of collapsed over the last few weeks. I mean, this has gone from being an intriguing story to basically a just a complete disaster, you know, a complete dark
Debacle.
stain on ufology. And you know, I think you could make the argument writing about the fact that a mummy was mistaken for a dead alien from Roswell, that is over the top, bizarre, and ridiculous, but we can learn a great deal from it as well. So, you know, to sort of answer your question, yes, I would write about something like that, but to demonstrate, you know, as I said, what we can learn from it.
You have written about it, and I know a lot of people consider this to be a stain on ufology. You could look at it in another way, in that ufologists took about 24 hours to completely dismantle this. Once it went public, the UFO community did a pretty good job of taking this and tearing it to pieces on its own. They didn't need
Oh, no,
debunkers to come in.
yeah, you're right. And I think the important thing about this, George, is that when we had the high-res slides, you know, the event in Mexico was May the 5th. When we got the high-res slides, you know, within minutes or hours after the event was over, and people were able to look at them and actually deciphered the placard, and which demonstrated that it was the mummified body of a young boy, et cetera, it collapsed. My big concern about this is, well, if the UFO community was able to solve this across a couple of days, why is it that the people who are hanging on to these high-res images for a couple of years before the big unveiling in Mexico, why couldn't they resolve it in a couple of years when the rest of the UFO community just figured it all out within days. And I think this is one of the issues of concern to people who paid out good money to either watch the footage, you know, on the, or watch the event, I should say, on the internet, or traveled down to Mexico or lived in Mexico, you know, and attended it. You know, why is it that the people who had the slides originally, why couldn't they have put this to bed 2 years ago so there would never have been any need for the Mexico event? You know, I think, yes, it's a good point to bring up that, you know, ufology solved this, but I just don't get why they weren't able to solve it if ufology, the rest of ufology could in a couple of days. And that's why I think, you know, we're seeing people now legitimately very angry. They paid out their money, and then not within like a year or 2 years of the event, but within hours of the event, the money they paid out to see footage of it or images of an alien was actually found to be images of a mummy. You know, it was sort of just outrageous, disgraceful.
What do you make of the arguments? Jaime Musan, for one, is still saying, look, lost in the shuffle here are some really interesting questions about the mummy, is that maybe it was misidentified and it wasn't really a mummy, and that it's, there's some physical differences there. My own feeling is, even if there is, it's so overwhelmed by all the rest of the stuff swirling around that it would never be resolved.
Well, I mean, here's my view on all that. I mean, if you've got something that, you know, looks like a mummy and it's on a display... you know, and it says it's the mummified remains of a young boy, and it's in a museum, then to me, common sense suggests you go with what it appears to be. You know, that they were clearly, the placard explains who it was donated by, where it came from, etc., etc. And I think if you confuse it, well, not confusing, but adding to the mix and trying to say, well, yes, it was, you know, identified as a mummy, but it really wasn't. Well, that just confuses things even more. You know, I think the logical approach to take is that the most logical down-to-earth explanation is the correct one. We've got the placard, we've got the, you know, the photographs, the high resolution. I mean, the main thing that a lot of people forget about is if you look at the body itself on that glass stand, well, right behind it, there's another head. It's like an animal's head. You know, it looks kind of like a bear,
like
or
a wolf
or something like that.
And
so to me, that's clear evidence that it's, you know, a museum-type environment. And I'm sorry, you know, the idea that you're going to mistake a mummy for an alien, and an alien is going to be mistakenly kept on display for years, to me, I just cannot buy that.
Going back to where the conversation began with the Mothman, we were discussing the possibility that military or intelligence agencies became involved, stirred the pot, muddied the waters, and you know, the whole discussion of John Keel describing himself as a demonologist. People have trouble believing there are folks in our government, in the U.S. government, or in military or intel agencies that have an interest in demons. One of the topics that I like best that you cover in this book, Secret History, is a revisiting this idea that there are people in the Pentagon, high-ranking people, who take this very seriously.
Oh, there are. I mean, this is an area, probably the most controversial aspect I've written about. And over the years, I mean, I wrote a book a few years ago called Final Events that addressed the whole demonic theory and what agencies knew. And this, over the years, you know, when you write a book, people come to you, and since then more information has come out, quite significant material, and it essentially sort of boils down to the idea, well, not idea, but the conclusion that there are several think tank type groups within government, sort of quasi-official groups, that have addressed the idea that yes, the UFO phenomenon is real, but it seems to have a lot of paranormal, supernatural overtones to it. And some of these groups have literally come to the conclusion we're dealing with something that is demonic, that sort of masquerades as extraterrestrial, as a means to get its claws into us, so to speak. And this story goes back, from my perspective at least, to 2007, when I interviewed an Anglican priest named Ray Beauchesne, who was a former state director of MUFON. And I talk about this in the book, about how, for example, Ray was... had a meeting with a couple of physicists working on a Department of Defense program to literally try and contact these entities in some sort of almost like a Faustian pact. And he essentially was exposed to this particular think tank type group that was really addressing the idea that, you know, UFOs are from a literal hell. And it's a very controversial theory, made even more controversial by the fact that official funding has been put out there to investigate it. So, true or not, you know, the scenario has been looked at quite extensively.
Well, I think it is true, and I've crossed paths with some of this myself. I'm not going to go into details, but there are elements in these agencies, high up in these agencies, who have issued decrees about not investigating UFO and paranormal stuff because they don't want to invoke demons. And they don't want this stuff because it's evil, and it's people can't believe that there'd really be people like that in positions of power in the military or government, but it's true.
No, it is. I mean, I've spoken to a number of people face to face from former government agencies who have just literally frightened to touch the UFO subject. Not frightened because of aliens coming down or anything like that, but from the perspective of demonic entities getting their claws into them on a sort of very personal basis where, it will affect them at a personal level. And, I think you can make, for example, a good argument that if you look at the Mothman stories, well, you had the UFO angle, you had the Men in Black, but then you had Mothman, which was tied in with the collapse of the Silver Bridge and almost like a Grim Reaper type character. And, of course, if it's just nuts and bolts aliens, how on earth would you have this sort of glowing-eyed, winged entity, and all these dozens of deaths? That kind of smacks of a supernatural aspect. Now, the only issue I have with the theory about it being demonic is not that it couldn't be. I think it's that emotive term, demonic, because it implies one sort of rigid belief system and people have this imagery of horns and forked tails and things like that. I think, that the term demonic has been applied to sort of supernatural entities that we may not understand what they are. They may be sort of interdimensional or something like that. And throughout the centuries and thousands of years, and based upon culture and belief systems, they've become known as demons. And in another culture, they're known as the trickster or something else. And so I think we could be dealing with sort of malevolent, multidimensional entities, but I'm sort of not personally comfortable with calling them demons because of the analogy it creates of, like, a fiery pit and, the
sure.
devil and all that kind of thing. I think we need to sort of try and figure out what these things are and, are they demonic or are they something that really just does not like the human race but is more of an interdimensional thing,
Yeah, well, I mean, you and I both know ufologists who would scoff and laugh at the idea that these visitors in the ships in the sky are anything other than aliens from somewhere else, and the idea that they might be demonic or demons or some kind of entity like that, you'd laugh at it. We don't know. We really don't know.
No, and I mean, you raise a good point, and I mean, what I say to people is if you look at today's alien abduction stories, there really aren't that many differences between what goes on in the abductions and, say, 500 or 600-year-old encounters with incubus and succubus, things like this, and I guess the sort of most infamous sort of she-demon, Lilith. If you look at the stories of Lilith and, this sort of predatory, supernatural female demon, that would have sexual encounters with women and men, it actually sounds like today's abductions, where you have, the sexual component and the genetic angle and the person unable to move in the bed, that sort of thing, sleep paralysis, you find the trends throughout the UFO subject that also exist through the, the demonic and occult angle as well.
These are some of the topics that you cover in this massive work, Secret History. When we come back, we're going to delve into maybe the largest conspiracy theory of all time. And now we know that all of our fears were absolutely true. I can remember my mom and dad dancing around to this song way back in 1957. I was a wee lad listening to Little Richard and Long Tall Sally. Much more to come with Nick Redfern in a moment here on Coast to Coast. It's one of my favorite bands, Wisconsin's own Bodines, a song about a gal who done her man wrong multiple times. Misery. We're talking about the secret history, conspiracies from ancient aliens to the New World Order. Nick Redfern has really cast a wide net this time. It's a great book, and we're going to jump into some of these conspiracies right after this on Coast to Coast. Welcome back. We're talking with Nick Redfern about secret history, his new book. Toward the back of the book, Nick, you mention a massive conspiracy, a global conspiracy, one that everyone listening to this program has sort of a direct stake in it. And if you had told people that this program was underway several years ago, they would laugh at it. They would scoff at it. Today, we know because Ed Snowden provided the documents that this massive surveillance program has been underway for a lot of years. Supposedly, they're not listening to our phone calls, and yet we know the facility they built in Utah is capable of storing every phone message in the world for the next 500 years. I mean, it fits in this book, doesn't it? That conspiracy?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no doubt that, certainly when it comes to Edward Snowden, I think he's obviously sort of polarized people into two camps. There are those who view him as, an American hero, and then there are others who consider him a traitor. I think what Snowden has done, he has demonstrated a need for massive debate on what should be done or shouldn't be done in the name of national security to protect the population. And I think the big issue is not that most people have isn't the fact that certain people need to be watched. People are legitimately against us and want to destroy us. But does that mean that everybody's got to be swept up in the process? And I think that's the big concern that people have. I mean, my analogy would be that if, say, somebody comes over on a 6-month student visa from North Korea or Iran, should they be watched very closely? Well, yes, they should. Of course they should when they enter the country, and they should be grilled carefully. Should an 85-year-old woman from Wisconsin taking a flight to see her grandson in Los Angeles, should she have her bag opened out and checked? No, of course not. But that's what happens. So I think, in other words, what we need is to have a situation where common sense is the overriding factor in all this. Yes, I don't think it's a bad thing to monitor at all. The telephone calls of people who have legitimate ties and there are deep suspicions about them, but just sweeping everybody up. I mean, if you have to do that in the name of national security to preserve your way of life, well, is your way of life actually preserved or is it altered? These are the big issues that this all brings to the forefront.
Is there anything you could say because of the Snowden revelations, this massive surveillance program that is underway, that's being debated in Washington this very week? Is there anything that it reflects on the other kinds of conspiracies in here? The fact that something so big, so massive, could exist behind the scenes and get very little scrutiny, what does it say about the credibility of other kinds of conspiracies that you cover in the book? I mean, it would seem to say there could be all kinds of things going on that we really don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you make a very good point with that, George, because you're right. This is an agency-run operation that essentially impacts on the lives of everybody, and nobody knew about anything about it. And so, when the skeptics say that regardless of what happened at Roswell, something strange happened, people say, or the skeptics say, well, there's no way something like that could be hidden for 70 years almost. Well, here's a situation where something clearly can be hidden, and not just from a few people, but from millions and millions. And I think the big concern as well that I have is that a lot of these conspiracies, and this gets into the really disturbing areas, actually fall outside of the confines of government, which kind of sounds strange, but it almost sounds like these so-called black budget and rogue and shadow agencies and things like this, where even the elected governments may actually not know, who's running some of these behind-the-scenes programs that are so buried so deep that they're not subject to congressional oversight, et cetera, et cetera. And they remain, you know, really hidden.
You think UFOs might fall in that category, right?
Yeah, I actually do. Where I differ with a lot of people in the UFO subject is that, you know, a lot of people sort of point the finger at the Air Force or the Pentagon or whatever and call them the bad guys in relation to hiding the UFO issue. My personal view is that regardless of what UFOs are, extraterrestrial, demonic, something in between, who knows? My personal view is that from a study of the data and the witnesses, I think at least a few decades ago, nearly all of this material, the important material, was sort of siphoned off to some kind of shadow agency that was answerable to no one, that was, you know, black budget funded, no congressional oversight. And that's why we're not getting really, you know, beyond this brick wall. And I actually think that when, like, the Pentagon and the Air Force came out with their Roswell report, I don't think they were lying. I know some people do, but I actually don't at all. I think they did their best effort, but admittedly, they, by their own admittance, they came up empty-handed. And I think if you can look at it from the strange concept that today's Air Force and Pentagon may not actually know what happened at Roswell, I think that is the situation. And I think the reason they don't know is because it's buried so deeply that even they don't have access to it today.
I want to go to the beginning of the book. You have some great chapters on ancient alien kind of stuff. And I know I almost sort of cringe when I hear the phrase ancient aliens anymore because it's received so much coverage. The success of the TV show, which is immensely entertaining, but man, if you watch it, every episode and all the offshoots of it, it seems like aliens were involved in everything that happened in early humans. And I have trouble with some of it. But there are a couple of things that you touch on that I thought were really interesting that I was not aware of. The stuff on the possibility of an ancient nuclear war. Tell me that scenario, what the evidence is.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is sort of intriguing but also disturbing because it kind of suggests the scenario that, you know, the human race exists in cycles. You know, we start, we develop technology, we reach a peak, and then we blow it, you know, and then we start over again and struggle, and over the passage of tens of thousands of years, the previous civilization gets forgotten about or relegated to rumors and legends of fantastic races and Atlantis and things like this. But there are, for example, a number of very intriguing stories of what sound like ancient examples of nuclear war. Now, one of the more intriguing ones is the Indian saga of the Mahabharata, which we know dates back thousands of years, and it's been speculated that it could be based upon even more ancient texts. It essentially deals with sort of a conflict between two opposing forces in northern India. And, you know, you'd imagine with something like a millennia-old story, it would be dealing with soldiers fighting on horseback, you know, spears, shields, bows and arrows, that kind of thing. It actually doesn't. You know, it talks about these mighty flying vessels, Vimanas, taking to the skies and unleashing these powerful weapons that, you know, have these gigantic flashes in the sky, bright lights, cities destroyed, and then troops falling sick in the aftermath. And when you put all this imagery together, it sounds like, for all the world, it sounds like, you know, sort of aircraft armed with nuclear weapons destroying cities, and then in the aftermath, people dying from radiation poisoning. There are other reports where, for example, various areas in the Middle East where sort of areas of fused glass have been, what looks like fused glass have been found. And this is like a byproduct of atomic explosions where the, you know, the sandy environment gets heated to such a degree that it turns into what, it isn't literally glass, but, you know, it's for all intents and purposes, that's the sort of generic term that's become known. And, you know, you can find stories like this all over the place of massive disasters that chillingly sound like an ancient description of a nuclear attack. I mean, that's the most famous ones, being like Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, that if you look at those stories retrospectively, it sort of sounds like, sort of a localized nuclear event to destroy these cities. And then, of course, you have the story of Lot's wife, in this event, sort of turned into a pillar of stone, excuse me, a pillar of salt. Was that really the case? I mean, theories have been put forward that, the idea that she was just extremely badly burned, by the events, the attack. So things like this are intriguing, but as I said, they're also disturbing for people because it sort of provokes the idea, will we ever learn, or are we destined to keep making the same mistakes every 10,000, 20,000 years, and then we return to savagery for 5 or 10,000 years, and then all we have left are a few remnants and fragments of old tales that today people say, well, that just couldn't be. Maybe they'll say exactly the same about us 40,000 years from now.
We're coming up on the 60th anniversary of the Trinity test, Alamogordo, the first nuclear bomb. And you draw a connection in the book to Robert Oppenheimer, these stories about ancient nuclear wars. And there are some cryptic comments attributed to Oppenheimer that kind of made the hair on my arm raise up a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, Dr. Robert Oppenheimer was the brains behind the atomic bomb. And there's no doubt that, the atomic bomb helped to end the Second World War quickly and decisively when the bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Oppenheimer actually came to sort of regret developing the atomic bomb. Now, what's intriguing about Oppenheimer, one, he had a deep fascination for the Mahabharata, this ancient Indian text we just touched upon. That in itself is interesting. More interesting is a statement that Oppenheimer made in 1952 when he was asked at a seminar, were the atomic bombs dropped on Japan and then the one prior to the Trinity site in New Mexico when the bomb was tested, he was asked, were they the first atomic bombs? And Oppenheimer said yes. He basically said yes in the modern era, as if to say, and said he stressed the term the modern era, as if to suggest that, well, yeah, it's the first ones we exploded. But it sort of left the cryptic kind of stance that maybe we weren't actually the first. We're just the latest.
Here's another ancient one, the Ark of the Covenant that you touch on. And, of course, I've heard, that ever since Indiana Jones and all that stuff, the Ark of the Covenant and all the kinds of stories, and you detail that there's a whole bunch of different ones. Well, one of the most interesting ones is that this was the Ark of the Covenant based on fairly specific descriptions, might have been a gizmo, a gadget, technology.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are a number of things that pointed that direction. For example, people were warned not to get close to it, not to touch it. Supposed to having to wear certain types of clothing. This sounds like as if it could be something that was, electric. For example, people who work, in the field of electricity very often have to, be grounded, rubber sole boots, that kind of thing. It sounds a little bit like that in some respects, that the Ark of the Covenant may be tied into, that sort of scenario. There are also stories, for example, about the
Something
Ark.
Something called a Leyden jar is what you mentioned in the book?
Yes, exactly. And, the scenarios, for example, that it may have been some sort of like an acoustic weapon as well, for example, the walls of Jericho when they were brought down, that sort of scenario of having sort of like a projected acoustic weapon as a device of technology. Whatever the Ark of the Covenant was, it was clearly sort of revered and feared by the ancients to the extent that, as I said, people warned not to get close to it, and it was shuttled and shuffled around from place to place to keep it hidden. So what it was really, we'll probably never know. But when you look at the story and you read the legends and, the old accounts, you really can put like a technological spin on it to suggest that it was some sort of device that if you didn't know how to handle it, you could be in grave danger.
You touch on all kinds of folklore, legends that grow up in different cultures. Bigfoot, of course, in Native American culture, is you trace it way, way back. And sort of in that same general chapter, you lump in cattle mutilations. You and I have touched on this a little bit in the past, but I wonder, has your view of this evolved, or where are you on it right now? Because that's such a weird angle to this that a lot of people connect to UFOs, rightly or wrongly.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the big issue, the big problem, I would say, with cattle mutilations. Not that it's not a genuine phenomenon. I do believe there is a genuine phenomenon that is nothing to do with, scavengers or animals or anything like that. The problem is there seem to be several legitimate theories that could it really be the case that there's several things going on? That's sort of where it becomes confusing. I mean, people do see strange lights in conjunction with cattle mutilations. People do see unmarked helicopters. But also there's, certain paranormal aspects that suggest like ritualistic, sacrificial aspects to some of these events as well. And again, I guess you could make the argument that, if there's a demonic or paranormal aspect to the UFO phenomenon, then you could also have that sort of spilling over into cattle mutilations, with some sort of occult angle as well. I sort of I'm drawn to several theories. I don't dismiss the outright UFO one. I think one of the more concerning ones, at least from my perspective, is this theory that it's connected to the issue of monitoring for viruses in the food chain. Emerging and growing viruses. I mean, the reason I'm so interested in that is because growing up in England when we had the whole mad cow thing
Sure.
in the 1980s, I mean, that demonstrated how quickly sort of a new and untapped virus could jump the food chain from cattle to people. Then you had the human variant, CJD, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. And, I sometimes wonder if, I mean, I'm sure, well, the sudden rise over the last few years in Alzheimer's in the United States, researchers have suggested, like Colm Kelleher, is it actually Alzheimer's, or is it something else? And is the monitoring of the cattle herd due to the fact that something has got into it, And I think that in many respects would be even more sort of frightening than the idea of extraterrestrials.
Yeah, well, Colm makes a pretty powerful case. Has a lot of evidence, circumstantial and a paper trail as well, to suggest that that's exactly what's going on, is that somebody's monitoring the spread of these prions, these indestructible prions, through the food chain. And it sure sort of makes more sense than just aliens picking up cows and carving them up and taking the good parts with them.
Now, that actually sort of gets back to what you said at the very beginning about using sort of mind control technology and things like this. I sometimes wonder if some rogue agency that might be doing this monitoring or black budget group, whatever, may have subtly encouraged the UFO angle, possibly with a few staged events, the angle of the cattle mutes, I mean, subtly staged a few UFO events to push people down the pathway that it is extraterrestrials. And there'd be a good reason for doing that. The only people who would take notice of it would be those of us in ufology. And unfortunately, outside of ufology, we don't get much serious attention. And of course, anybody who of standing and, who has a good background would probably stay away from the cattle mute issue for a bit fear of being dragged into the UFO angle. So, it works very well, keeps all the respectable scientists, as it, from their perspective, away from investigating something like this. And so I think that could come into play in the cattle mutes, the idea of, well, we want to keep this under wraps, let's just subtly spread a few UFO stories, and then, people will stay away from it, or they'll laugh at it,
Well, it also explains why you'd leave the carcasses there, because you want to put on a show. You want to make sure that it's so weird everybody notices it, or it's marginalized in terms of its credibility, and so you just leave the bodies there and let the chatter begin. We're talking with Nick Redfern about his new book, Secret History: Conspiracies from Ancient Aliens to the New World Order. Covers a lot of ground. We'll get to it as much as we can right after this on Coast to Coast AM.